six matters on the calendar, three oral, the first of which is Green versus Minnesota Bureau of Mediation Services et al. It looks like counsel are all ready to proceed. You'll each have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if the appellant wishes to use that time. As you approach the podium, make sure you give us your name and the party or parties you represent. Is there going to be a division of time over here, or is it one?
Just one, Your Honor.
Okay. The podium is adjustable. There's a little toggle switch. I don't exactly know where it is, but people find it and go up and down. Adjust it to your comfort. Whenever appellant is ready, you may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Jacob Campion. I'm an assistant attorney general for the state of Minnesota. With me today is Solicitor General Liz Kramer, and we're here on behalf of the Department of Human Services and Minnesota Management and Budget. In 2016, respondents sought access to the names, home addresses, and personal telephone numbers of approximately 27,000 individuals who provide personal care services to elderly individuals and persons with disabilities through DHS programs. The question in this case is whether that information was public at that time. The legislature has passed a specific statute that governs this issue, and it sets forth certain criteria that must be met before that information can be released.
Counsel, why doesn't Minnesota Statute 13.43 Subdivision 2 apply?
It does not, Your Honor, because Section 179A.54 is the specific statute that covers this data, and it was passed more recently. So even if 1343 applies, you need to reconcile the two with one another. And principles of statutory interpretation say that the specific controls over the general, and the more recently passed statute controls over older ones. And Section 179A.54, Subdivision 9, is both in this case. In addition, if you apply Section 1343 to say that information that is not public under one statute, you can get it through 1343, you've rendered Section 179A completely meaningless, which also violates principles of statutory interpretation and construction.
Why doesn't 179A.54 Subdivision 2, which says for the purposes of the Public Employment Labor Relations Act, these personal care providers are executive branch employees. Why isn't that the bridge that ties the Data Practices Act and PELRA together?
A couple of things, Your Honor. First, it says they are public employees for purposes of 179A, and they are not required to be treated as public employees for any other purpose. And
right, but the purpose here is they are seeking access to a list under 179A.54. So isn't, in fact, their status here at issue for the purposes of PELRA?
True. And so if you want to see whether they're entitled to the information, you look to the specific statute that the legislature passed. They said you're going to maintain a list of names and addresses of providers, and it's going to be distributed in this manner. There are three circumstances in which it's distributed. First, if you're a union wishing to represent providers, and you can demonstrate that at least 500 providers support that representation, you're entitled to a list and three subsequent lists for a total of four. So there's both a limit that you need to make a 500 card showing, and there's a limit on the number of lists that you can get. There's also a limit to the information that's on the list, names and addresses. The second circumstance is if you're elected the exclusive representative, you can get updated lists upon request. And then the third circumstance is if the list is publicly available. And a list is publicly available when it is available to an employee organization. So that refers back to the first two circumstances. And at the time of their request in 2016, the list had not been made available to either an employee organization or the exclusive representative.
They hadn't been requested by anybody.
Correct. Exactly.
There's a difference between, I mean, the statute talks about a showing of made to the Bureau of Mediation Services or a request, and we didn't have a request here.
That's correct, Your Honor. You did not, and so the list was not public at that time. And 179A is the specific statute that controls. And so available.
Subdivision 9 indicate that those are the only circumstances under which the information can be available?
Yes. I mean, when interpreting a statute, you need to presume that the legislature did what they did intentionally. And what they did was provide for names and addresses, and they also provided the circumstances in which that would be disclosed, the two circumstances. And then once you give it to a union, the legislature said, then you need to make it available to everybody. But unless that criteria has been met, that list cannot be disclosed.
Well, but does just because it lists out the criteria, there's nothing in 179 that says that this is the only means of disclosing information, right? It doesn't foreclose any other option. It doesn't foreclose any other statute that could be interpreted to allow disclosure, correct?
That's not correct, Your Honor. It does foreclose because you need to give effect to Subdivision 9. So if you say you can get the information that's prohibited by Subdivision 9 under some other statute, like 1343, you've made Subdivision 9 completely meaningless. That means...
Where does the word prohibition appear in Subdivision 9?
I'm sorry?
You said if you can get the information that's prohibited by Subdivision 9, where is there a prohibition in Subdivision 9?
So the prohibition are the three circumstances in which it's public. Where it can be disclosed. The prohibition is it can only be disclosed.
Where's the word only?
Well, it says, upon a showing to the Commissioner of Mediation Services that at least 500 providers support the representation, you can have access to the list.
Right.
So if you need to make a showing to get a list, you can't get it without the showing. That's the prohibition.
But the word only isn't there.
Well, again, this section has to have meaning. And so if you say the same information is available somewhere else, then these prohibitions have no meaning.
It's not exactly the same, though. Under one provision, you've got the disclosure of names and addresses of individual providers. The other one has names. There's overlap there. But also talks about work telephone numbers, as well as work locations of those public employees.
Sure. So.
So there's not a complete overlap. It doesn't seem like there. It should completely preclude one statute. Should preclude the other.
Yeah. So a couple of things about the work location and work telephone number. If that's truly what the request was for, and not the information on the list, then you still need to reverse the judgment against DHS and MMB. MMB did not possess that data, nor are they required to. They simply should not be in this case at all. They did not have the data, and they are not obligated to disclose it. As for DHS, they do not.
Although they're the ones that under Subdivision 2 of 179A54 are deemed the employer of personal care providers.
That's true, Your Honor. However, in a Data Practices Act case, if you're bringing a claim against an agency for not disclosing data, the agency actually has to have the data. They can't disclose something that they don't have and are not required to maintain.
So who is, so just DHS is required to maintain the data on employees or on personal care providers who are deemed to be employees of MMB?
Yeah, the legislature has delegated that responsibility to DHS. However, if this was, click case was, how this case should have gone is it should have been a claim under 179A.54 against the Bureau of Mediation Services, because the Bureau of Mediation Services is the one under the statute who is in charge of distributing the list per the requests under that statute. And they were a party below, but all the claims against them were dismissed. However, the interpretation that the DHS and MMB are offering today is the same as the interpretation of BMS. So in the alternative, you know, it's the agency's position that 179A.54 unambiguously determines that that list was not public in 2016. However, in the alternative, if you conclude that the other side has a reasonable interpretation of 179A.54, then you have competing reasonable interpretations, which makes it ambiguous. And this court defers to the agency who is charged with implementing that statute, and that would be BMS.
Well, but it's an issue of statutory interpretation. That's something we look at de novo as well.
True, you would. However, there is deference when there's an ambiguous statute. And as I said, our argument is that it's not ambiguous. But if you conclude that both sides have a reasonable interpretation, then you would defer to the agency's interpretation of 179A.
Well, we don't give complete deference to the agency's determination. We still have to look at it de novo to determine what the interpretation is. That's just one of the factors that we look at.
If it's ambiguous and the agency has a reasonable interpretation, this court does defer to the agency.
That's the other part that you need to take into consideration.
Right.
Is whether the agency's interpretation is in fact reasonable.
Correct, Your Honor. So that brings me to a second alternative argument, that even if you say that the respondents have the only reasonable reading of 179A.54, you still need to reverse the judgment against DHS and MMB, because as I said before, the agency who is charged with administering 179A.54 is BMS, not DHS, not MMB. We have already talked a little bit about 1343, but I just want to make a few more comments. So as I said before, if they conflict, you need to reconcile them using the principles in 645 about irreconcilable statutes. And 179A.54 is the more recent and more specific statute, and so that would control over any conflicting analysis in 1343. In addition, Section 1343 just does not apply because they're not employees for purposes of the Data Practices Act.
But now I'm looking at 256B0711, the Representation Act, mm-hmm. and that seems to tie access, at least by employee organizations, to information to both 179A and 13.43. Isn't that sort of the linkage that would suggest the court needs to read all these provisions together?
I don't think so, Your Honor. So two things on that sentence you're referring to. So first, that sentence doesn't apply here because it's talking about employee organization.
I understand
that.
I had that in the question. But sure. I'm saying that, but doesn't that instruct that all of these statutory schemes are supposed to interrelate?
But only as they provided in the statute. They only referred to Section 1343 in that limited circumstance about employee organization access to other data. The fact that they only incorporated that piece of it means that they did not intend to apply any other aspect of 1343. That sentence has no purpose if 1343 applies. You wouldn't need to separately set out that 1343 subdivision 6 applies about employee organizations. So that indicates that the legislature only intended to incorporate that limited aspect of 1343 and only as it applies to other data beyond the list for the union.
So is there any way for a group that is seeking a decertification election under 179A subdivision, or whatever that subdivision is, 179A12 subdivision 3, is there any way that group of personal or care providers would ever get access to the list and be ever able to mount a meaningful decertification campaign, if you will?
So they would say they would get access to the list if it was publicly available under the statute. But I take your
point. Which statute?
Under 179A.54, subdivision 9.
That ends up being an older list, right?
The ones that are public are older now.
By definition, it seems like we've got a population of PCAs who are in flux. People are going in and out. So the older list is not only old, it's relatively useless.
And that may be, Your Honor, and if it is, in
we
fact...
end up with, Judge Bjorkman's got a great question. Don't we end up with a union in perpetuity that can never be decertified no matter what?
No, I don't think that's the case. But to that question, that really is a policy question for the legislature. The executive branch agencies need to implement the statute as it was written. And so
right,
if the respondent...
But at the same time, we're charged with not enforcing a statute that leads to an absurd result. It doesn't make sense for a party to request information and get stale, outdated information.
It's not an absurd result, Your Honor.
How is that not? How is that not an absurd result to get information that's useless?
It's not an absurd result. The legislature has provided that they can only get it under these circumstances. There are other ways to communicate with providers, either through media, internet, social media. They've brought in decertification petitions without the list. And the legislature very reasonably could have concluded that once a union has organized, that's a very big deal. That triggers lots of legal rights, both on behalf of the union, the providers, and the government, and that they could have reasonably decided that they're not going to just let 500 people come in and try to disrupt that, because the whole point of exclusive representation is to maintain peaceful labor relations between the government and people providing services.
Right, but you want to have people representing you that will represent the interests of them, and if there's a dispute there, and if there are a significant number of people, the statute also provides for, if you have at least 500 people saying, hey, you know what, we want to switch unions, we want to switch representation, that there should be a path for that as well, right?
I see I'm out of time. May I respond?
You certainly may.
Thank you, Your Honor. As I've said, the executive branch needs to apply it as written. The agencies do not believe it's an absurd interpretation for the legislature to limit this list in this way. And there are other ways of communicating with providers that respondents can utilize and have utilized. They have a website. They have ways for providers to sign cards electronically. They do media appearances. There are ways to communicate absent this list.
You will have 5 minutes on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Respondent.
May it please the court. My name is Tom Revenue, and appearing with me is my partner, Doug Seaton. I'm appearing on behalf of Chris Green and the other personal care attendants as the respondents in this case. And in sum, the district court should affirm the district court's grant of summary judgment. And as the court has obviously acknowledged, the matter before it is a matter of statutory interpretation as to whether the respondents were entitled to and continue to be entitled to receive a list of the personal care attendants' names, addresses, and telephone numbers. And the only logical conclusion is that the law and the Constitution allows the PCA such access to the list. The appellant's argument essentially asks that this court ignore the fundamental policies behind statutory interpretation, reading the statutes in conjunction with each other. They essentially ask that this court ignore the purpose behind the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act, which is to promote government transparency. And frankly, the appellant's argument essentially asks that this court throw out democracy. They essentially say, hey, deny the PCAs the right to a free and open election. Deny the PCAs the right to government transparency. In fact, what they say is it's okay that the government provided the union with a list of names and addresses and telephone numbers, personal care attendants. And it's okay that 5,800 of 27,000 PCAs participated in an election where only 3,500 voted for the election.
Well, it seems to me that I understand that those are the background facts. But I'm wondering if you contend that your clients fall within the list of people entitled to, or the list of people entitled to the list, or the most recent copy of the list under 179A54 subdivision 9.
Yes, and
of the three groupings would they fall?
Sure, Your Honor. If we're going to focus on 179A54 subdivision 9, I think we also have to focus in addition on 256 B711 subdivision 4F, and just to read them in conjunction. The Commissioner of the Department of Human Services is required to maintain a list of names and addresses of the individual providers, and they're required to maintain that on a monthly basis. Getting into your question with regard to 179A54 subdivision 9, there's three scenarios where access is allowed. One, beginning in September 1st of 2013, upon a showing to the BMS, to the Bureau of Mediation Services, by any employee organization, with at least 500 cards signed, they're entitled to access to the list. That's scenario number one. Scenario two is the commissioner of the Bureau of Mediation Services shall provide the list after certification. Okay, so once the union is elected in as a representative, they can ask, they can request a copy of the list.
And that didn't happen here.
And that didn't happen here. Right. And there's a reason it didn't happen. It's
but
because
nor
under
did the first one happen. I mean, you're not contending your clients are an employee organization as defined in 179A03, are you?
We're not, Your Honor.
Okay.
But with regard to your question, with regard, well, the union didn't ask for a list to the Bureau of Mediation Services. Well, the collective bargaining agreement between the state and the union provides all of this information plus a whole host of other information. So there's no reason for the union to ever go to the BMS to ask for the list. They already have access through it through the collective bargaining process. And so that information is readily available to the state. It's readily available to the union. But where we get access is in the third scenario on 179A.54 subdivision 9 sub 3, and it says, when the list is available to an employee organization under this subdivision, the list must be made publicly available. And the key word is available. The list is available to the union. They may not have requested it, but the statute doesn't say, contrary to the appellant's argument, the statute doesn't say that the union has to request it in order for it to be available. The statute says if that information is available, then it's available to the general public. And that's how you have to read the statutes in conjunction. But in addition, if we turn our attention to Minnesota Statute 256B, 711, subdivision 4F, the language in that provision also allows for access. It provides that in relevant language that the commissioner shall share the list with others as needed for the state to meet its obligations under Chapter 179A as modified and made applicable to individual providers under Section 179A.54 and so to facilitate the representation processes under Section 179A.54 subdivisions 9 and 10. And subdivisions 179A54, 9 and 10 refer to the representation process, that's provided under PELRA. And it refers to both the opportunity not only for an employee organization to seek to represent individuals, but it also refers to if individual providers seek to decertify the union. And so when you read the two statutes together, certainly access to the employee list is mandated by the statutes. The other point we wanted to make is that when the court is reading the statutes, they read them obviously as a whole and they read them in conjunction. And courts, when they're construing a statute, they seek to avoid unjust results or absurd results and unjust consequences. And in this instance, in essence, what the appellants are asking is that you deny access to the list to the PCAs, and in doing so, by denying access, an absurd result occurs. As we noted in our briefs, these personal care attendants are all over the state. 27,000 plus individuals located all over the state without access to their names and their addresses and the telephone numbers, it's virtually impossible to campaign against the union not having that information. Now, the appellants argue, or they stated in their brief, well, we could have provided you with summary data. We could have given you at least they list or it give you the number of individuals who are part of this bargaining unit. Of course, they didn't provide that information despite requests for access to names, addresses, and telephone numbers. They didn't provide that information. That came up in their briefs that, well, we could have provided you summary data, but that summary data is not useful. The summary data doesn't provide the PCAs with an opportunity to communicate with others.
It doesn't identify them.
Right. Exactly.
Your purpose is to be able to contact those people.
Exactly. To contact and communicate. And without having that opportunity, you can't, there's no way to participate fully in the processes allowed under PELRA. And so by denying access to the list, essentially what the appellants are doing is they're denying the PCAs the right to participate in a free and open election. And clearly that is not what the legislature intended. Clearly that's not what the Constitution intended. And clearly to find any other way, any other decision would lead to the absurd results that certainly this court should not go down. The other issue that's out there is there's also an equal protection clause issue.
Did you make that argument in the district court?
I don't think it was clearly raised before the district court. However, certainly the issue of that a court interprets statutes in a manner that it's not absurd was raised.
Not every fairness issue is an equal protection issue.
That is true. The other piece, though, is that with regard to the Equal Protection Clause piece, what the state wants to do is say, hey, the union, you get access to this list, but when the PCAs seek to decertify, you don't get access to this list. And that's obviously, that is not what the law provides. The law provides for open access. Minnesota Government Practices Act provides.
And yet Subdivision 9, in as my reading goes, lists three discrete situations under which individuals have access or parties have access to the list. And I think, you know, your interpretation of the last sentence of Subdivision 9 is that, you know, if there is an employee organization that has requested, then the list would be available to them, then it's public. And I'm not sure how the facts of this case get us there. I don't think we have an employee organization that has made a showing to the commissioner or the Bureau of Mediation Service, so how can we say the list is available to an employee organization on our record?
Yeah, well, because this court, when it interprets a statute, it interprets a statute using the plain and ordinary meaning of the language. And the word available means that it's accessible.
Well, but the word available refers to the word list, not the word information. It refers to list.
I would agree with you. When the list is available, when the list is accessible, the fact that the union did not ask for the list or request the list does not take away the fact that that list was, in fact, available.
Well, that was the purpose of my question, though. Isn't the information available as opposed to the existence of a list available?
I would agree with you.
It's the compilation of the information.
I understand your point, and the list, I would submit to you, Your Honor, that the list is available. The list is being provided as part of the collective bargaining agreement. They're providing a whole host of information. And although the information is not just limited to the list of names, addresses, and telephone numbers, that list does exist with quite a bit of additional information.
So is your position, because the CBA requires DHS to maintain a list of all the PCAs, that it is therefore available? Is that your argument?
Well, that's one of the arguments, absolutely. But in addition, it's available because obviously, as we note in our brief, that they are government employees and we are entitled to that information under the Government Data Practices Act. And the Government Data Practices Act specifically provides that, this court has said that the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act codifies the fundamental commitment of making the operations of institutions open to the public. And under the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act, courts have also stated that in recognition of this policy, the courts construe the laws in favor of public access. And so the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act provides the alternative avenue to getting access to that information.
If you're right, if we agree with you, then does subdivision 9 of 179A54 serve any purpose at all? What's the point of having it if you can get it all under the Data Practices Act?
Well, I think I wouldn't say that 179A54 sub 9 is irrelevant.
But if your argument is that this information, regardless of who's asking for it, is publicly available because all of the personal care providers are branch or state employees under MMB branch, then everybody would get access to the list all the time. And what's the purpose then of Subdivision 9 spelling out three scenarios under which access is provided?
Well, I think with regard to 179A.54, that is part of PELRA. And certainly 179 Subdivision 9 provides access in three scenarios. One, during the certification process. Two, after certification. And three, when that list is available. And we submit to the court that that list is available and should be provided to the respondents, but in addition, that information is also available under the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act. And when the legislature promulgated 179A.54 or 179A.54, they were taking into account how the election process would take place for purposes of PELRA. However, the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act also provides or allows for access to employee information. And, you know, one thing that I want to make point of, and I see my time.
Go ahead and finish the thought.
The last point I wanted to make was that even assuming that the personal care attendants are not employees for purposes of the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act, that list should still be publicly available, and I point the court to the decision involving the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers versus St. Cloud, where a list of a government contractor's payroll records, including its employees' home addresses, were public records and were required to be disclosed to the IBEW.
Thank you. Appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you wish to use that time.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a few brief points. First, there is no equal protection claim pled in the complaint. That's not part of this case at all. The second is their interpretation of available renders most of the 179A.54 subdivision 9 meaningless. If it's available simply whenever DHS finishes compiling it each month, then it's available every month to anybody for any purpose, except the first sentence of the statute talks about a 500 card showing and the four list limit, and that still has an ongoing purpose even after a union has been elected exclusive representative, because Minnesota law allows rival unions to challenge the exclusive representative in what's called a representation election. So there is still an ongoing purpose for those provisions, and the court needs to interpret it to give them effect. And they're not given effect under respondents' interpretation.
So, how, counsel, would you interpret available under that third option?
Yeah, so when they refer to available, the legislature is referring back to the first two circumstances. So a list is available under the first circumstance when a union's made the 500 card showing, they've requested the list, and it's been provided to them. Available means under the second circumstances when the exclusive representative has requested it and received it. And this is consistent with the legislative purpose because of who these people are. These people provide care to elderly individuals and persons with disabilities. And the record shows that many of the providers provide care to a relative at the relative's home. And so the address of the participant and the provider are the same. So the restrictions serve a purpose of protecting the privacy of the providers, but also the participants who share an address with the provider. And you can see in 256B how careful the legislature was to make sure the linkage between the provider and participant isn't disclosed, that the participant's name isn't ever disclosed. However, to effectuate the statute, they did allow limited purposes where they were going to provide it to a union. And in those circumstances, they also provided for it to be made available to everyone. So if you give it to the union, you need to make it available to everyone.
Well, the prohibition in 4F, so many statutes here, subdivision 4F of 256B0711 is that the list shall not include the name of any participant or indicate that an individual provider is a relative of the participant or has the same address as a participant. But what it doesn't say is that the list shall not include the address of the participant under any circumstances. It just doesn't say that.
Yeah, participant information is protected under 1346, welfare data of DHS.
Right.
So that information should not be disclosed under any circumstances. However, for the provider's address, they do allow it. Oh, I'm sorry.
I understand your policy arguments. I get that there's reasons why you wouldn't want to do it, but I don't see it in this. I don't see those reasons in that policy in the statute.
Yeah, I think it's evident on the face of 179A54 subdivision 9 in that they are restricting the types of information that can be disclosed and the circumstances in which it would be disclosed. So there was a reference to the sentence in 256B.0711 that talks about sharing the list with others to meet the obligations, and then it references 179A subdivision 9. So any sharing is subject to the restrictions of subdivision 9. And then subdivision 9 and 10 do not discuss decertification elections. They only discuss certification elections. So I don't think respondents can rely on that either. And then the last thing I'll note is the International Brotherhood case that was cited. In that case, the court was not able to find another statute that covered the information. But here, there's at least two. You have 179A.54 subdivision 9. That says it's not public unless the criteria has been met. In addition, even before 179A.54 subdivision 9 existed, this data was not the personal contact information for providers and participants was not disclosed by DHS under 1346, which covers welfare data. So unless the court has any questions, I am finished.
It appears we have none. Thank you. The matter is submitted. We thank counsel for your briefing and argument. We'll issue our decision within 90 days.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you.